You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network.
Protect your dream home with American Family Insurance. And you can weather any storm. You'll also save up to 25% by bundling home, auto, and life. American Family Insurance. Get a quote. Find an agent at amfam.com.
Products not available in every state. Discounts may not apply to all coverages on an auto or home policy. Discounts do not apply to life insurance policies. Visit AmFam.com to learn how discounts may apply to you. American Family Mutual Insurance Company, S.I. and its operating companies, American Family Life Insurance Company, 6000 American Parkway, Madison, Wisconsin.
Can you believe there are only 13 days left until the holiday season is no more? If you haven't gotten a gift for the Broadway lover in your life, get Be a Broadway Star today. It's the only Broadway board game there is, the best-selling Broadway-themed gift on Amazon.com. Go to BeABroadwayStar.com and get it today. 13 days left. Ah!
I want to be a producer with a hit show on Broadway. I want to be...
Praised by Lin-Manuel Miranda as the future of musical theater, SUFS creator Shayna Taub makes Broadway history as only the second woman to write the book, music, lyrics, and star in her own original new musical. Don't miss the much-anticipated Broadway debut of the singular artist that Forbes calls visionary and Billboard anoints as one of the most inventive voices in musical theater. SUFS, the original new musical from Shayna Taub, is now playing on Broadway at the Music Box Theater. Get your tickets today at SUFSmusical.com. The Outsiders on Broadway tells the story of finding where you belong when the world refuses to accept you. Based on Essie Hinton's beloved novel, featuring new music from Jamestown Revival and Justin Levine, and directed by Danya Taymor, Entertainment Weekly says that with brilliant staging and some of the most captivating stage fighting currently on Broadway, The Outsiders has the power to inspire an entire generation. Get your tickets today at OutsidersMusical.com.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to the Producer's Perspective podcast. I'm Ken Davenport, and I'm super excited about my guest today, partly because one of the first times I actually met him in person, and I'm looking at him right now to see if he remembers, I was on the other side of the microphone with him asking the questions. Now the roles are reversed. Please welcome to the podcast, honestly, one of the smartest advocates and best administrators we have working in the business today, Mr. Howard Sherman. Welcome, Howard.
It's nice to be here, Ken. And I do remember.
Good.
Very early in the days of my podcast, as I recall.
Yes, it was. It was. We talked about Off-Broadway. So Howard is currently the director of the Arts Integrity Initiative at the New School, also the senior strategy director and interim director of the Alliance for Inclusion in the Arts. He was the executive director of the American Theater Wing for almost a decade. He's a fantastic blogger and a fantastic tweeter, even when he disagrees with me. And, well, by default, he became the chief archivist of the infamous Ham for Ham before each Hamilton performance last year. Check out his YouTube page. It's quite extraordinary, the number of views that stuff got. So, Howard, what I love about your career is the diversity in the types of work you've done. So I want to start by just asking you, what drives you to be so passionate about the theater? What is it that makes you want to go, I got to be involved in this community. I want to write about it. I want to work for the wing. I want to work for inclusion for the arts. What is it?
It's all I ever wanted to do. I never conceived of something else that attracted me more. When I was getting ready to go to college, certainly swallowed all of those things about, oh, it's a terrible way to make a living, and you know so much, and I was in a good school, I did all these things, and I certainly for the first year was trying to find something else that might interest me, and there wasn't anything. It's all I ever wanted to be a part of. So what drives it is, frankly, finding ways to be part of this world. In high school, I performed. I acted once in college. I directed a couple of shows in college. But I even stopped anything on the performance side or creative side by the end of the first semester of my sophomore year. I just knew that it wasn't for me. Whether I had talent or not, I have no idea. I doubt it. But what I didn't feel that I had was the ability to constantly sell myself. I found I was probably better at if not selling, promoting the thing that I loved. It's an interesting life when your avocation is your vocation. There's very little separation. What do I do in my free time? I go see more shows. But what drives me is just I've never found anything that excites me as much, that I enjoy as much, that I hope other people will enjoy as much. And I'm driven by just helping them maybe know something more about it. I guess if there's a through line to my career, it is that idea of information and knowledge about the theater. And whether that was back when I was doing PR or when I was doing my podcast or what I do now in terms of advocacy, I think that's been the real consistent part of it, even though the job titles vary widely.
So what was the first job you had in the business after school or during school?
Well, it was during school. My great fortune was that even though I had gone to college and wasn't going to do theater, part of my financial aid package was that I had to do 20 hours of work study paid for. And there was a box office job in Performing Arts Center on campus. And that really was my first paid theater job. I worked box office for a couple of years, and then the last 2 years of college, I worked as assistant to the associate managing director of the Performing Arts Center. I had my first fully professional job doing PR for a new theater company in Philadelphia during my junior year. So I left school already having some professional credits, and then started, and I'd done a little PR work, as I said, professional work, and I'd done some other film promotion stuff. And so that's sort of what brought me into the fully professionalized world after college.
What was the first show that you ever saw when you were a kid? Do you remember?
The first show I ever saw was a children's theater production at the Long Wharf Theater in 1967 for Stephen Garfinkel's fifth birthday party. I do not know what the show is. I have a visual image of being in Long Wharf, which at that point was a year old. And while I've never been able to determine what the show is, in conversation with Arvin Brown, who was the longtime artistic director, but initially ran the Children's Theater Company, he couldn't even figure out what the show would have been. But whatever it was, he directed it. That's as much as I know about it.
First Broadway show?
First Broadway show was The Magic Show by Stephen Schwartz. I had seen the national tour of Fiddler on the Roof in New Haven about 5 years earlier, but it was definitely The Magic Show. And then Beatlemania was next.
Ooh, Beatlemania. I saw that on tour myself. So, look, you've been in a variety of positions in over a couple of decades now on Broadway.
More than a couple.
I know. I was trying to be nice there. And what's the biggest change you've seen since when you started on the administrative side of Broadway? So not creative.
I think we need to be clear that in terms of Broadway, I've been Broadway adjacent is the way I would describe it. I came to the wing in 2003. While the wing job obviously has a relationship to Broadway through the Tony Awards, I wasn't working on Broadway per se. My name is never been on the title page or the listing in the back of a playbill on Broadway. I had a great ringside seat to how Broadway works at the Wing. But in point of fact, I've always worked for not-for-profit organizations, whether they are service organizations or producing organizations. So that said, I don't know that if you want it, what have I seen changed in the time I came to the Wing, the 13 years since then? I would say probably the biggest thing is the escalation of price and the rise of the secondary market.
Do you think there's anything we can do to bring prices down, or do you think this will just keep going up and up and up forever?
While I did very poorly in economics, the law of supply and demand has reached Broadway in a way that it was strangely, there was always a certain amount of it, it was underground. It's now very open. The fact is there is a finite amount of inventory that any show has to sell in a given week, in a given month, in a given year. And when demand outstrips that, then prices rise. And while Hamilton is looked at almost as if it was the first show where this ever happened, I think it's the first show where it's been this high demand where the secondary market has been as open. We have to remember that it's 10 years, only 10 years ago that the anti-scalping laws were removed. And I sort of thought at that time, oh, this isn't going to end well. There has always been scalping. I think there will always be scalping in some form or another. But when scalping is transitioned into being called the secondary market and made so open and easy, and you literally go on websites to buy a ticket, and that same website is prepared to sell you a ticket on the second, resell a ticket essentially on the secondary market, it's blurred the lines in extraordinarily difficult ways. Remembering that commercial Broadway is fundamentally responsible to its investors. It is a business. I think it's very difficult to turn around for those businesses to turn around and say on a consistent basis, we are going to forego revenue in order to maintain accessibility. I'm not saying I wouldn't like to see them do so. I gather there's some rhetoric around J.K. Rowling wanting to keep the Harry Potter play accessible when it comes here. I don't know what's happened in London in terms of a secondary market for that show, whether she personally can do that because of her extraordinary wealth and her commitment would be fantastic. I'm sitting here talking to an independent producer who I imagine would find it difficult to say to investors, we're just not going to charge what the market will bear. Out of altruism. Would you? Could you?
Oh, God, here we go. Questions are turned around already. To be honest, what I think what you do, and I think Hamilton has done this to some extent already, and I think Harry Potter should as well, which is you do have a fiduciary responsibility. This is why these people give you this money. And a lot of people will say, oh, they're going to make so much money. Well, what people forget is that when I raise money and people make money on a show, it usually means that they've lost money on many shows before, so they're trying to recover actually other losses. And I'm sure that's for many of the Hamilton investors. They're actually recovering from previous shows that they've supported. So I think the answer is you do isolate. You have a small group of tickets that are cheaper, and then you do isolated big charitable events, just like any other large-scale corporation would do, just like Verizon does, just like the Yankees will do, or just like anything that is very Chase Bank. So that's, I think, the answer is there. I'm asking the questions. Dang it. So let's talk creatively for a second. Grade the creative output of the New York theater scene right now as compared to when you started. Do you think we're producing artistically better plays and musicals than we were when you first came here?
I see so much that I can't even tell you what was in what season all that easily. So I have to hedge on that. I think I can't say that it's more so than when I came to New York in 2003, but I'm very pleased to see a Broadway certainly that can support Fun Home, that can go ape for Hamilton. There's definitely a range, and I'm really glad to see it. I was disappointed actually that Falsettos and Fun Home didn't end up overlapping. I thought it would be quite wonderful to have both of those shows playing at the same time. Just because of what they're about, what they represent in terms of how our society has changed. But I think, you know, analyzing any given season is kind of a mistake. I think there's been a lot of great work, and there's been a lot of stuff that you wonder how it got there. And that's just the nature of certainly the commercial.
You do a lot of work in the hinterlands as well, consulting with regionals.
I don't even like you using that word. They are not the hinterlands. They are part of this country who simply happen to not be in New York. And that is not a failing, and it is not that Steinberg map of New York where there's New York and there's everything else. You were saying.
Perfect segue. What I wanted to know is if you think there are things that the New York theater scene can learn from the other theaters around the country. Because too many of us, including me, as I just did, separate us from the rest of the country and certainly look down on some of those other theaters out there. Oh, we're the, just like New Yorkers, I think, look down on some people that may live in Indiana or East, wherever. So is there something that we can learn from how some of these great theaters across the country are being run?
When you say we and you say New York theater, New York
theater is not a singular thing, because there is Broadway, there is off-Broadway, there is off-off, there's institutional theater.
Something I, as a Broadway and off-Broadway commercial theater producer, can learn.
I think the most important thing that exists, particularly at institutional theaters, and to a degree to the performing arts centers now, which are by and large not-for-profit entities, is how to maintain a relationship with an audience. I think it's gotten tougher. I think a lot of people have shifted away from subscription and towards single tickets. But in New York, I think people always think about what's the show, as opposed to what's playing at Hartford Stage tonight, what's playing at Steppenwolf tonight. I think the idea of a producer identity, not in the way of David Merrick, but in the way of that there is this entity that creates a body of work over time for an audience in a place, is something that has value, in the sense that if you know where the work is coming from and you get a sense of who it is who's doing that work, then I think you could conceivably build audience for your shows based on who you are, what your aesthetic is, and what your track record is. We look at Hollywood right now, and I think it's a little extreme, but we actually now see ads that say from the producer of, and they'll name. Now, to a certain degree, it's they're trying to invoke anything they can to interest somebody in the product. But when that producer is Pixar, then that brand, as a producing entity, signals the kind of work that's going to come from them. And I think producers are very broad-minded. I think people do a lot of work that has a wide range of topics, et cetera, et cetera. But there's something to knowing who's behind it, because the relationship for all theater going is connecting to people and sensibilities. And whether it's a performer, whether it's a director, whether it's a writer, I think that model of knowing the producer is something that's much stronger outside.
Speaking of the Pixars and the movie studios, what do you think about the movie studios and their presence on Broadway today, as opposed to 20 years ago when they didn't seem to care less?
I think it's difficult to finance Broadway shows. It's difficult to finance off-Broadway shows and even regional shows, because some of, you know, it's not a uniquely Broadway thing. We're seeing shows developed and shows supported by studios. You know, we have, I'm going to remember which company it is, but Dead Poets Society has a credit in the 200-seat off-Broadway theater. Now, part of that is they own the rights, the original screenplay, et cetera, et cetera. I think if the kind of money that's available in film or in television, for that matter, can come into theater, it's terrific. And if over time that money and the people behind that money are willing to move beyond simply reiterating properties just as they were for the exploitation of the existing familiar names, but actually realizing that something can be done beyond that, I think it can be quite extraordinary. And we're seeing that, you know, a bit with, you know, Once, for example, which, you know, the show in many ways was bigger than the movie. Am I remembering correctly that might have had some involvement, not from a studio per se, but was that one of the shows that the Broccoli family was involved in? Or am I misremembering?
Fred Zola was a producer on that.
As the lead.
Yes,
yeah.
And married to Barbara.
So, you know, when you think about resources that may have been generated in part by the James Bond films being brought to bear on a quite remarkable musical, I think that's fantastic.
It's a very, I've actually never looked at it that way. And it's what you're suggesting in a way is that each studio, Disney may not be able to produce a small independent artistic stage production of something, but they could create an independent film studio that's a subset of them in a way. Right?
First of all, I think Tom Schumacher has involved Disney theatricals in things which are not singularly replications or adaptations of Disney films. So I think that does a disservice. Tom's actually, you know, you said nice things about me at the top. Tom's one of the smartest people about theater overall that you can meet, and enthusiastic and supportive. And so you know, I think actually that work's already happening at a certain level. Can there be more of it? Sure. Because as people like to say, you know, what it costs to produce certainly a play on Broadway, even close to what it costs to produce a dramatic film. You know, we also have to look at the amount of activity that's going on Broadway right now that's generated by Scott Rudin. And, you know, with certainly early on, there was very often a related credit for Paramount, which at that time he had a producing relationship with. It wasn't being brought to bear on putting Paramount movies on stage. It was being brought to bear on some really, really interesting theater. So I do think there's emerging in the world. We see Bob Greenblatt from NBC, you know, and his involvement. The idea that theater isn't a plaything for these people, but that they are serious and committed to it, I think is great.
So obviously you work with Inclusion for the Arts. Give me take our temperature on diversity and inclusion right now. How do you think Broadway is doing? Last year, everyone was jumping up and down. What an amazing year for diversity in Broadway, but give us the real truth.
Well, my comment earlier about it's very hard to look at any single year of Broadway and divine anything, because there can be, you know, just a couple of things can swing your perception of what's going on Broadway. I think, you know, there's no question. Spring Awakening, show you produced originally from Deaf West, it shifted the awareness of the acceptance of performers with disabilities on Broadway. This season, to the best of my recollection, the one show that we have is Glass Menagerie, has cast a woman who is a wheelchair user as Laura, a character who has always been described as having a disability, but certainly in any major production never played by someone with a disability. But if you look at it on a percentage basis, the number of performers with disabilities on Broadway has just been reduced. In terms of racial and ethnic diversity, that's a show-by-show thing. When you get an allegiance, it's going to tip the balance. I think part of what we also have to look at is not simply was there someone in a show, but at some point you have to look at it across work weeks. You know, how long were actors, diverse actors on Broadway? How, you know, we can look at who directed shows, because the direction is in a way finite, and then it's just how long the show runs. But, you know, yes, we need to look at, we're still at a huge deficit in terms of gender equity on Broadway. I think overall, racial diversity, disability diversity has a long way to go, because it's still treated as something special. Until we get to the point where there is equity and where it's no longer a story that there are shows with a large number of Black, Latino, Asian, Native American, people with disabilities, all female creative teams, that's when we'll have actually achieved something. Right now, it's still outside the commonplace, and therefore something to remark upon, and therefore we're far from the goal.
So I want to talk about writers specifically, because I've always been a big believer that that's where it starts. If you have writers writing for people of color, writers of color writing about what they know and their experiences, it will slowly transform. I'm just a big believer in that. So I want you to imagine that you're speaking to 5,000 theater professionals, Broadway producers, off-Broadway producers, regional theater artistic directors, the whole group of them. What's the one thing you would tell them to try to get more diverse writers writing today? What's one thing we can all do, all the people listening out here today, that we can try to get more writers of color, more writers with disabilities? This is something I've spoken about at a government conference, actually, about this, writing for the theater and produce.
First of all, well, I think those are two separate questions. I think there are diverse writers out there. The question is, are people willing to produce it? And do the economics of producing on Broadway support producing at least some of those works? Are they of a scale where they are best served? So I don't think, you know, I think it's really about, as it should always be, looking at more scripts, consciously saying, let me go see work at places I don't normally go to. I mean, I've You know, when I was at the Wing, because of Tony responsibilities and because I was doing Downstage Center and interviewing people, and I always wanted to have seen what they were currently in, if I'd already been there, there was a certain level of work that it was prescribed that I had to see. I've consciously tried in the past 5 years to go see work that is out of my, not a question of my comfort zone, but probably my instinctual zone of what I think I like. Tomorrow, I'm going to see a show at the 3LD Technology Center simply because I've never been there before. And I just said, you know what? Read about this place. Here there's interesting stuff there. It's a different idea of how we approach a theater because by its nature, it's meant to be employing technology in service of a story. And maybe I'll see something wonderful. Maybe I'll see something that I don't particularly care for. But the idea that whether it's me, whether it's other audience members, whether it's producers looking for writers, it's about going to places you don't always think to go. It's about not waiting for reviews to tell you to go because the work's there. Yes, there's a finite amount of time, so people use certain tools to help them make decisions. But I think taking chances just in what you choose to see or perhaps read can bear fruit. Then the question is, can you make it work? And there are shows. What I always find marvelous is the shows that people in the biz buzz about saying, oh my God, you know, it's great, but I can't believe they're going to bring that in. That's going to be so tough. And then those are shows that succeed. I mentioned Once. I don't think Once was a sure thing. Certainly Fun Home was not a sure thing. You know, look, I remember people thinking it was insane of Kevin and Jeffrey to transfer Avenue Q. I mean, just thought it was nuts. And so work that doesn't fit the mold needs to be looked at. And it's out there. It's not a question of convincing writers to write it. It's the willingness to engage with them that will change things.
You're very active on social media with the Twitter account, the YouTube channel, the blog, all of it. Do you think this is something that all arts administrators, artistic directors, people that sit in an office and not in a rehearsal room every day should be actively engaged in the 21st century?
You know, I don't think it's for everybody. And I don't think that an individual should force themselves onto social media because somebody tells them they should. If they're not comfortable with the format, if they're not, to a degree, enjoying it, then they're not going to engage well, and it's just not going to work for them. You know, you talk about my YouTube channel. My YouTube channel consists almost entirely of 61 Ham for Ham videos. And the funny thing is I had shot 5 or 6 of them before I stopped to say, how do I get these out of my phone? I wasn't even posting them. I was just filming them, figuring I'd do something. So for me, YouTube was a tool for a certain thing at a certain time. And almost everything else I put on YouTube is either something I find amusing, you know, and that gets 100 views compared to hundreds of thousands of views for Hamilton. Twitter was the first social media platform that I took to. I actually was Facebook resistant, something I regret, because I think it's proven to be an extraordinary tool. But Twitter, which in contrast to talking to me in person, where I have trouble saying hello in 140 characters, it's fascinating, you know, how I sort of found myself boiling down thoughts so that I could fit it onto those and into that very limited messaging capacity. And I also used it as a tool to just say, here's a lot of stories about theater from the hinterlands, Ken, that I could share to try to in my small way, at least for the people who decided they would follow me, to see stories they might not otherwise look at. Because I do look at what's going on in many other cities, and I figured there might be some people who found that interesting. Facebook, ultimately, the power of Facebook to accelerate and spread material is extraordinary. And sometimes in the writing that I do, the advocacy that I do, I've put up material that's you know, just flashed around in ways I never expected. I've other things just laying it. And that's what's, you know, so confounding is it's not like you can truly master it. You can try to game it. You can try to spend money to reinforce it. But that algorithm is a tricky little thing. And of course, if any of us actually knew exactly how it worked, then they'd just change it again.
As they do seemingly every other day between them and Google is driving people crazy.
But I think individually it is in some way a form of expression. It is most successful when it is an expression of the person and not merely billboarding, you know, what you're doing and selling whatever your company, your organization is selling. Because if all somebody gets from you is marketing messages, they're going to turn you off. So it's how do you balance things that you genuinely want to share with people, things you think that people will find interesting, things that people will find of value. And then if you have some institutional messaging, how do you work that in?
So between your time at the Wing and your time in these other organizations, there've been a lot of programs and initiatives that you've worked on. What's been the most successful for you in terms of getting young people to come to the theater that you feel theaters around the country, people like me, we could develop ourselves or institute to try to encourage that? Anything ring a bell?
It's hard to say because there's no direct correlation. It's not like I tagged things or that any of the things we did, we set up to be revenue streams either at the Wing or subsequently.
What's your gut tell you? I'm asking this because I believe in your gut that you could look at these programs and you said, you know what, that was a really good one. More people should be doing stuff like that.
I guess I would go back. I mean, in Downstage Center and the Working in the Theater program, which the Wing was doing before I got there, and in the Wings, the short documentary series that we did. I think the more that can be created about theater to inform people about theater that isn't about selling them a ticket is what's going to support theater. Because if every message is tied to marketing, then it fundamentally becomes transactional. Whereas if people feel they're simply gaining value by spending time with it, again, it builds up a relationship and it builds up knowledge. And the more people know about theater, the more people have theater demystified for them, I think the more they'll appreciate it because there is this ongoing belief that theater is elitist and that in some way it's monolithic. And the more variety we can show people in more different ways, the better. And if you don't like this show, then maybe you'll like the next one. But if you can look at it and understand it, I mean, actually, one of the things I always try to bring up, things that I do from time to time, is helping people to understand the difference between a text and a production. Most people see a show and they think that's it. That's all it can ever, that's what it is and will always be. Part of it is people don't see as much theater as you and I do, and that's obviously an economic issue. But understanding sometimes that you can see a show and not like it and realize, well, maybe the play is okay, I just didn't like how they did it. And learning that, which is hard because it requires, you know, people to see multiple productions that are significantly different. I actually suggest doing it with movies sometimes, and movie remakes is the way you can do it. My particular example of late is the two True Grit movies, because the structures of the film are identical, virtually scene by scene, and because they're both based on the original Charles Porter's novel, which at times had scenes written out like a script, even the dialogue is the same. So when you if you watch John Wayne's performance, then you watch Jeff Bridges' performance, you see that even though they're playing the same character, they bring different things to it. And I think people understand that. It's a really great tool about the fact that unlike film, theater isn't fixed and is in the sense of permanent fixed, and that each element brings something new to the table.
What do you think Broadway looks like in 20 years?
have no clue. I don't spend my time thinking about that because A, I'm not a Broadway producer. B, I don't believe that Broadway is the be-all and the end-all of theater. I don't believe it's the brass ring. I'm concerned that the shift, which is not certainly in my time in New York, but that's been ongoing to building shows to last for decades, has the potential of reducing the opportunity for variety on Broadway. Fortunately, we have these small theaters that aren't well suited for those kind of big appeal shows. But what we've watched is a bifurcation in which the vast majority of plays are now produced for 16 weeks, whereas musicals, the goal is always to have them run forever. With plays, it's the war horses, the curious incidents are now the rarity, because they are actually conceived in a way that allows them to continue. They're not star driven. The play becomes what's important. I mean, for whatever it's going to mean, when Harry Potter gets here, it won't matter who's in Harry Potter. I don't mean that to say that the actors are in any way important to telling the story, but the show is already the star because of what it brings from the books and the movies, and indeed from the fact that it's already been staged in London. It's hard to do that, but shows like Curious Incident show that it's not impossible. And the idea that we could have shows that might run a year or a year and a half, as plays did when I started going, terrific.
Interestingly enough, I was just reminded, as you said, Harry Potter, Curious Incident, War Horse, all have two very specific things in common. One, all of them are spectacle plays, mm-hmm. as well, large spectacle plays, almost musicals in a way.
Yeah, they have scale to them.
And two, all of them based on best-selling books.
Sure, but let's also think about some of the other long runners. I'm going back a little further, but God of Carnage had a good run, and there was no spectacle there. There were names, but after the first cast, they weren't people you thought of as necessarily box office, but people were familiar with them, they could get interviews, et cetera, et cetera. And art, for that matter. You know, again, whatever you may think of Yasmina Reza's work, she creates vehicles whereby you can bring a wide variety of performers into those shows. And it works because I saw all three casts of God of Carnage. And, you know, you literally suddenly, okay, now this character is British. Now this character is smaller than another character. And so the physical relationship between them has changed. I mean, that, again, to the idea that it's a production, not a text. It must not always be someone who looks and sounds like Jim Gandolfini in that show is great. And it allows the shows to live on. But if the shows are so associated with who's in them that it is impossible to move on afterwards, that's problematic. And that is a self-fulfilling thing about saying plays can't run. Well, they could run longer if they're built differently, and perhaps the marketing and the communications needs to adapt so that there's more of that.
Okay, my last question, my infamous James Lipton-like genie question. I want you to imagine that the genie from Aladdin comes to visit you, knocks on your door, and thanks you for all the incredible advocacy that you've done for the theater and getting new audiences to come and more diverse people in our audiences and on the stages, and is going to grant you one wish in exchange for all your hard work. What's the one thing that drives you crazy about the theater that can get you so angry, so mad, that you'd be jumping up and down, that you'd ask this genie to wish away or change in an instant? Only one. And I know you can get riled up. You got riled up at me twice in this podcast already.
So yeah,
what's the one thing
that
gets you the most?
But see, I love theater, so I don't get riled up about theater. There may be things about theater.
I usually say Broadway, but I wanted to.
Don't say Broadway. I think the thing, I can't say it riles me up. It's the thing that I think is most important, and I think it's, you know, I think I'd need more than one wish or a very generous genie. and definitely not a GD written by O. Henry, because there'd be some bad, you know, weird twist at the end. I think all theaters, the venues, and I think this is happening outside of New York, and it is a real estate issue, and I understand the limitations, but I think the more that theaters can be comfortable, and I'm not talking about reclining seats, I'm talking about restroom issues, I'm talking about legroom issues, I'm talking about lobby space so that theaters are gathering. I mean, in a way, Broadway has the hardest time making itself a comfortable experience, even though it is charging the most in order to have the experience. And so long as going to theater requires patrons to accept uncomfortable situations and sacrifices in order to have the experience, that is fighting against the idea of theater being a regular, comfortable, acceptable, popular thing that is simply a part of people's lives. And now that I've talked all my way through that, I'd like to change my answer. I would like the genie to fund all theater the way Signature Theater is funded, so that the cost of going to theater is eradicated and people can simply go to theater as easily as they can go to a movie.
You talked himself into two answers there. You got two wishes out of that genie.
Well, you know, it's funny. I say this often to people. I think by talking, which is sometimes dangerous, but I had to find my way around. And as I was talking about, and it's not that I don't feel the first issue is not important, because I think you go to some theaters outside of New York and it's like, this is lovely. And we can walk into the garden during intermission. And so it has a warmth. I used to work at Goodspeed. It's one of the most beautiful places to go. I mean, I used to think every day that I was driving over the bridge into Brigadoon. So I think that is important. I think the experience around our going to theater, not just the thing on the stage, is important. But ultimately, yeah, if I had a dream, it would be that everyone could go to theater. There would be no secondary market that people could then buy those tickets cheaply and run up the prices. And that truly, even when we have things like, okay, we're going to have this performance for 10,000 or these performances that are going to serve 10,000 school kids. That's great, but it's not great if economically then the school kids can't possibly get into a show again, because what we've done is we've teased and they've had a great experience, but it's been a tease. And we have to find a way to make it so that it's not just when it's underwritten. And if the genie would magically make it so that it's affordable for people to go and producers can still make their, you know, make some money putting it on, and everybody can have a living wage working in it.
Great answer. And I do want to personally thank you for all your great advocacy on behalf of all of us in the theater. If you want more Howard, check out his great Twitter. It's terrific. H.E. Sherman is the username, and his website, hesherman.com. Thanks to all of you for listening. Thanks again for being here, Howard, and we'll see you next time.
Don't forget, only 13 days left until Christmas. Go to BeABroadwayStar.com. Finish up your holiday shopping for the Broadway theaters in your life. Get one, get two, get one. Win a Tony. Play it yourself. You're going to love it. There's a reason it's the best-selling Broadway-themed gift on Amazon.com. BeABroadwayStar.com. Check it out today.
They say well-behaved women seldom make history. Just ask the Supps. A vibrant and wholly original new musical, Supps celebrates the real women who changed history and their story that is more timely than ever. See the show Variety calls an epic tour de force new musical. Deadline Cheers is a rare Broadway feat and leaves audiences inspired to keep marching. Supps has arrived on Broadway, and not a moment too soon. Get your tickets today at suppsmusical.com. If you love Broadway gossip, you are not going to want to miss any episode of this podcast, Singular Sensation, The Triumph of Broadway. Plenty of dramas unfold on stage, but the best dramas unfold backstage. and there were no bigger dramas than behind the scenes of Sunset Boulevard.
So you were being crucified over here, but yeah. Not there.
No. No, because I was turning in a performance that would get standing ovations. Excuse me.
So check out my podcast, Singular Sensation, for all the juicy and gory details of Sunset Boulevard.